sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Hurricane Sandy strikes. Employment data looms and earnings season is interrupted. We have this, lots to talk about, including our special guest Das is here with us today. We're going to talk about the weather and what a mess it's making of all sorts of things, not only in the U.S. and Northeast, but also probably with the markets. All this and much more on episode number 287 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And again, I do apologize for the delay in putting this up, but we wanted to make sure we knew what was going on with the hurricane, the markets, and kind of give you a little bit of a report and a kind of a guide to what to do here and to understand what's happening with the implications of this situation. You know, it's not only that it was, you know, a bad hurricane approaching that we found out over the weekend really more about, but it's really the place that it happens, because New York is the hub of not only finance when it comes to U.S. and global markets for that matter, but also if you think about the transportation and the links of the airports and what's going on around the world, because of everything is affected dramatically. And if it wasn't bad enough that the economy was just limping along before this happened, now we have another situation to deal with, because this shutdown of markets and of New York and the Northeast for 2 days, at least as we know it right now, is a major situation when it comes to the economy. Some people have calculated close to $10 billion a day of losses from consumption when it comes to the hurricane that's happening right now, because of the effect, again, on the whole eastern seaboard and around the world. But this situation is very frightening. It's it's an act of nature, but this is a situation that we need to be aware of. Now, the futures markets closed on Monday morning, and they were down slightly. They kind of vacillate around, a little bit of thin trading because many traders are not working at their desk in New York, but they're around the world trading, of course. They're opening up, they decided, for electronic trading at 6 o'clock in the evening, 5 p.m. Central on Monday, and closing at 9:15 in the morning, which I think is a really bad idea, by the way, because what's going to happen is that the overnight session is going to be very volatile and thin, thinner than probably than usual, and it's really going to spook a lot of investors. So I would really not take too much notice of just what's happening in the initial day. We'll see what happens the next day. Clearly what has happened overnight in the Asian markets, there was actually a nice ride up when we saw that there were some better things happening around the world. But yet at the same time, when the decision was made to actually close the equity market trading on Monday, things kind of fell apart. And that really was not really a good sign. We'll see what's going to happen, but I wouldn't be too reactionary. Hopefully by now, anyway, you've set up your portfolio somewhat defensively, because the trend has been, as we've told you, it's been kind of really getting kind of ugly. We just did a report on the earnings and the outlook of earnings was compared to the sales revenue forecasts, and it's looking really kind of questionable as to how companies are going to make their earnings numbers, considering the fact that sales expectations are just dropping very, very sharply over the next three quarters. So again, not only do we have a slowing economy and one that, yes, we saw a 2% GDP number, but a lot of that had to do with government spending. But at the same time, we have a situation here where, well, frankly, this hurricane is not going to help. We saw what happened with Japan. It does help certain areas like construction and cleanup and all that, but it does hurt retail and most of the economy when it comes to such a major, major situation like we're seeing here with power outages and markets down, et cetera. Now, one of the things that we're going to see here is that there is a possible postponement of the NFP data, the employment numbers on Friday. They're talking about that already, that they may not be able to produce the actual numbers on Friday. That's going to be interesting, because this is the last number that was going to be seen before the election, which is coming up very shortly. And the question is now, well, what are we going to do to kind of gauge what happened? And again, uncertainty and questionable timing of things is just not healthy for a market on the short term. In that period of time, people get very concerned and you see things moving around very sharply. And again, with the low liquidity that we've seen lately and the further lack of liquidity we're going to see, if in fact there are a lot of power outages throughout the Northeast throughout the next few days, is going to be kind of troubling for markets that already were having a tough enough time standing on their own. Now, meanwhile, we see things like Amazon come out with their earnings and they're a shortfall and they're a loss big time. They're guiding lower, et cetera. Stock goes down 7% after the close, after the announcement. And the next day does exactly what it did last time around. And it went up about 7%. Apple shook markets dramatically. I mean, Apple stock was halted just as futures were halted at 4:15 in the afternoon on Thursday. And what we saw from there was a terrible reaction by the NASDAQ 100 futures and the S&P futures on the fact that Apple missed on revenues and guided lower. And then miraculously the next day, wouldn't you know it, Apple comes back and almost kind of moves into the positive territory for 10 or 15 minutes and then comes down about 1.5%. And this is the second time both companies have done a very similar maneuver where they have guided lower or come out and missed estimates for one reason or the other, guided down their margins, et cetera, but investors are just not believing it. You know, the real question is how long are these companies, particularly Apple and Amazon, going to get a pass for this? I don't know. Technically, Apple hit its, I believe it's 200-day moving average and then kind of popped right off of that. So did markets. We will see if actually things can hold right now over the next several days because we're continuing to see a degradation and a degrading of economic situations because of what we're going to see with the hurricane. But also probably what we're seeing is definitely a slowdown in revenue. There's no question about that, and a slowdown in earnings when it comes to the current quarter. And outlook doesn't look any better. So again, positioning of your portfolio right now should have been a bit more defensive, a lot more defensive than you have been. And while you may not have been necessarily out of the market, maybe you would have been hedged as we've done, maybe you have some short positions if we talked about, et cetera. And I think this time it is really the kind of the straw that's going to break the camel's back in terms of the economy moving forward over the next 6 to 12 months. You need to really focus in on all the uncertainty that's going on right now, not only from the hurricane, but also by the elections, fiscal cliff, which we wrote about in our quarterly commentary for clients. And, you know, these are things that you really need to be focusing on right now. Now, gasoline spiked about 3% when we found that a lot of refineries were going to be knocked out of service for a period of time. And then it kind of slowly but surely came back down. What happened was that there was a realization that the storm passed many of the refineries, and while it'd be shut down, it wasn't as much damage as they initially thought to those refineries. Oil, though, came down. It slipped below $85 per barrel for a little while on Monday and then actually crept back up above 85 to about 85.5 at the close of the session. Now, what's interesting here is that you have to remember that the refineries are going to have a dual kind of movement right now. First, when you shut down the air traffic and you shut down the systems throughout the Northeast, et cetera, there's going to be a drop of consumption in terms of fuel. So that's going to obviously hurt the overall the need for oil, et cetera. On the other hand, what you have is the refinery shut down for a period of time. So inventories on gasoline over the next several days that have to be refilled and people kind of filling their cars up due to emergency situations, using it for generators, et cetera, that's going to be kind of questionable. But if there is any permanent damage to any of the refineries, which, again, we don't see that right now, that's when you'll see the spike in gasoline prices because they won't be able to produce as much gasoline that is necessary. Oil clearly has been growing in terms of inventories, and you know, you have to look at that in the big picture of, you know, how much consumption is there right now, and maybe there is a bit of a slowdown in terms of the use of oil. So we're going to see what happens there. Before we get to DAS, I want to mention a couple of things. First of all, I want to mention that we have been nominated and we're on the slate for Podcast Awards for 2012. The voting will start November 1st. So the Disciplined Investor got a nomination for the People's Choice Award for, I think, the third year in a row now, and also for the business category. And DH Unplugged got a nomination for the general category. So when that voting opens I hope that you would go and vote. You can vote once per day, and you have to put your email in and then confirm that you voted. They want to make sure that machines and robots are not kind of, you know, doing a number on those. So basically, you have to be a real person. Put in your vote, and I really appreciate that. A couple other things we'll talk about. You know, the area of earnings keeps on coming up in terms of guidance. You know, kind of like, okay, what they did with earnings recently is what they did last quarter, but really we need to pay attention to the guidance. Baidu came out with a number. They kind of met on earnings and all that, but they guided down. That's the Chinese Google, if you will. That stock has been very volatile. We see that it's kind of been moving towards the 114 range. We actually bought it on a bounce and actually alerted Trigger Point Research subscribers to that, made about 8% in, under a week or so. But now we're going to see what kind of strength it has, because if you break below the support level here, which is about the 105 area or so, you know, you may see a quick move down towards about in the 90s right now. There's really not much support below that. And if they are, in fact, coming in with a much lower revenue than expectations, and in a market that is not really in the total mood for holding up a stock just on, you know, the potential, particularly those that are located in China, I would watch that stock, but keep that on your radar screen. I think that's something that's very interesting to take a look at, because long-term Baidu is still a great, great company. I'm not suggesting buy it. I'm just saying just watch for the support levels. And if you own it right now, you know, be aware of those, because it could be a real flush when markets open again. The other thing I'll mention is that when markets open again, realize something. You do not want to be the first one into trade. The algorithms are going to get a little wacky due to earnings season, and you know, there's going to be some weird pricing going on probably, and who knows what's going to happen with cancellations and all that, especially depending on the amount of damage that Hurricane Sandy really creates. So I think that you really need to just be hold on, breathe deeply, take a little bit of time to consider all the things that are happening, but realize that there are a mountain, an absolute mountain of concerns that are hitting investors right now in the face. And again, aside from the hurricane, aside from Europe, aside from a kind of moderating but slowing China, you have the fiscal cliff and the election. And who knows where that's all going to go? Many polls have said that Romney and Obama are kind of tied in this level. Well, you know, this hurricane situation gives Obama a lot more face time, a lot more media attention. So we're going to have to see. And then you have to also realize that certain areas, who knows how long they're going to be out of power, and are they going to be able to actually vote people? You know, people are going to get out there and actually vote, depending on what happens there. So these are kind of the things that we're really facing right now, and I want you to kind of pay attention to those, okay? Just kind of, be aware is really what I'm saying here. I guess the other thing that I want to talk about is, before we get to DAS, I just want to mention two things. I want to mention the European markets and the euro. What we may see as a result of the hurricane is a flight to safety. And as the euro has been coming down recently, you know, came down after that big spike that we saw in the 129 range or so, watch the euro, because there is a tremendously high correlation to the euro and the stock market. A lot of times I post that on Twitter. That's at Andrew Horowitz. I posted kind of as I see it getting a little bit too tight, and it's on a daily basis, tick by tick, I post it. You can see this amazing correlation between the euro movement up or down and the S&P futures. It's kind of spooky. So I want you to kind of watch the euro, especially if you're trading, by the way. Watch the euro, see what's happening there. But, you know, right now there seems to be some additional problems mounting within the eurozone where, again, they can't come up with a straight answer on the banking supervision. There's a lot of comments about, you know, you talked about this, but really not doing it. Greece is getting an extension. How long is that going to last? How much is that going to cost? I mean, just the list goes on and on and on of what's happening in Europe, and there's been no resolution. We'll probably get into a lot more of that with DAS. The only other thing I want to mention is GoToMeeting. Now, this is a perfect example, if you have power, unfortunately, if, you know, how you can use a alternative to just going to meeting in person. You know, if you got to meet somebody in, let's say, Las Vegas, and you're traveling out of Connecticut or whatever, you may not be able to get out. Well, instead of doing that, you could actually have a GoToMeeting conference, and you just simply log on, share your materials, and talk back and forth, eye to eye, spend some time with them, and it's basically, you know, no problem, because you didn't have to cancel the meeting. Yeah, you're not face-to-face touching the person. You are face-to-face on the computer. But you know what? This is a great, just a great endorsement for the power of something like GoToMeeting. So what I want you to do is you can go check it out for yourself. 30-day free trial over at GoToMeeting.com. Click the try it free button and then just put in the code podcast and you get 30 days free of GoToMeeting. Great stuff. Now we have a great friend, a good man, a very soothing voice. I love talking with him because, you know, us Americans, we think anybody that has either an English or an Australian or maybe other or a mixture of those accents are much smarter than us. And I got to tell you something. If Das was from Brooklyn talking like this, you know what I'm saying? He's still a lot smarter than everybody that I know. Anyway, Das, how are you, buddy boy?
I'm very well, Andrew. And you?
I am pretty well, thank you. Lots going on. We were close. We were on the same side of the world for a little while there. I was in the Philippines. I was so close to you.
Well, only about 9 hours flying.
Well,
so it was very close.
So there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about. We have things like the U.S. elections, corporate earnings. One of the things I think is really interesting that I wanted you to discuss, and this is, you know, a little bit of a brain game, where the last two major announcements by policymakers in the U.S. and Europe were pretty much stating that not only are we all in, but we will continue with unlimited amounts of rescue, bailouts, funding, etc. And I was wondering, since the markets and people constantly look forward to what can be done if things don't go right, is the message that they're sending that there's unlimited amounts wrong because they can never come out and say we're going to, you know, do double unlimited?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think there's a pivotal moment, I think, that 2012 will be remembered for, which is in July when Mario Draghi basically said that he would do what it takes to actually protect and support the euro. And I think that was an interesting statement in itself. And while Chairman Bernanke did not quite go the same way, if you read all the Fed statements, he's basically shifted very much to employment, to growth, and he's saying much the same thing in terms of he will do whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, Mervyn King, who's the UK governor of the Bank of England, said much the same thing last week.
Yeah.
So I think they're all in, is the best way I would put it. But as you correctly point out, the question is, now that you've said you're going to give it everything, the question is your best going to be good enough? And I think the defining thing of this year was a really puzzling phenomenon, which is that everybody in financial markets who actually know that these people are the people who, A, failed to see the crisis, B, have stumbled in dealing with it, now they've decided to believe that these people have the solution, and which is kind of curious.
Right.
And in 2013, I think we're going to see a retracement. And the retracement is going to come from different sources. Because in Europe, what you're going to see is that despite the fact that Draghi has said that he's going to do whatever it takes, well, the problem is the Germans, who are his paymasters, may throw a few spanners in the works. The second thing is Bernanke has a different problem because he's going to keep doing what he's doing. And don't forget, he's pumping something like 80 billion U.S. dollars a month into the economy, which is about $1 trillion, which is about 6% of the GDP. And he's going to find that it's not terribly effective. And King, well, King's got a whole series of problems, mainly because he's got to find a, you know, a speaking gig after his term as governor of the Bank of England.
And a book
so
deal.
So all of that is going to be rather interesting. And I think the ultimate figure that everybody's going to focus on next year is the growth figures are going to be awful. They're basically we're going to see all the momentum go out of this. And it's actually fascinating. I had this discussion with somebody from your side of the world who said, you know, 1.5%, 2% growth isn't bad. I said, you're absolutely correct. In this world, it's not bad. But the problem is you need something like a 8 to 10% budget deficit, unlimited funding from the Federal Reserve, and zero interest rates to achieve that.
Right, right.
So the question is, once you withdraw any of that, what's going to happen.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty amazing the amount of money that's actually been put into the system and what we got out of it. You know, that's just, I find to be really quite astonishing because, you know, it just doesn't add up.
Well, it's fascinating because I look at the central bank balance sheets around the world, and before the crisis, there was, say, 5 to 6 trillion. These are the major countries we're talking about. Today, it's 18 trillion heading for 20 trillion, which basically means the central banks alone have pumped in something like $12 to $14 trillion, which is like 20% of global GDP. And if you look at the central bank balance sheets as percentage of a country's gross domestic products, this is like the United States, like Europe, it's like 20 to 30%. I mean, basically, what the Soviet Union couldn't achieve through communism, you know, the central banks in other parts of the world have achieved through capitalism. They own the economy. And, you know, everybody keeps saying to me, how far is this going to go? I said, well, I don't really know, but I just watched Japan. So we'll be up to about QE8 at some point in time, and QE9, at which point the Federal Reserve will be buying stocks, is what the Japanese did.
The only thing that rivals that is the Rocky sequels. You know Rocky?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, well, anyway, it was a bad joke. Now, but I had you laughing on the back end because it was such a bad joke. Now, let's switch over for a second because there's a few things ahead of the actual results, which will happen over time. And I think there's a lot of ugliness inside of Europe that obviously they're covering up, as I call it. They're using chocolate icing over a pile of dog shit. And it looks good at first, but don't take a bite. And, you know, I think that that's a lot what's going on. And, you know, we saw it with the LIBOR situation where clearly they held back for a number of years because they figure that people forget. It won't be as bad. You know, and if they told people the real numbers and the real things at the time, what would happen is that they wouldn't have confidence. And who knows what bank would have gone out. So they use the Machiavellian approach where the ends justify the means, right? And they say, well, you know what? Let's not say anything for a while till it comes out, because by then, hopefully, everything will be fine. But now we have a situation where it's in front of us and we see it, which is this fiscal cliff. It's this thing that everybody's all nervous about. It's all over the place. And the basic issue is what? They're going to roll back the Bush tax cuts. And the CBO says something like it's going to be a 5% cut to GDP over 2 years. But what's your take on this? Is it going to happen? Are they just going to push it ahead? Or what's the deal?
Well, firstly, you've got to look at it doesn't really matter who comes into the White House. And the reason it doesn't matter who comes into the White House, it seems strange to say that, is the chances are that his ability to actually get both houses of the legislature, the House of Representatives and Congress, to pass anything is minimal. Because he's not likely to get unanimity in terms of one party controlling all three. And as you remember, when Obama came to power, and President Obama came to power, he actually controlled the legislature, and he couldn't get anything passed then.
Right, exactly.
So basically,
yeah, exactly.
Under this circumstances, nothing's going to get passed. And then you have to look at the visceral issues. The visceral issue is very simple. On the one hand, you have an economy which is extremely weak, and I think this is where it's important to differentiate between the real economy and the financial economy. The financial economy, because of this zero interest rate policy, is quite buoyant. I mean, the S&P 500 is not that far off its peak. And generally, the financial markets have done pretty well. But on the other side, the real economy has huge weakness. And I love it, the fact that everybody gets excited about housing starts. And I just pointed out, yes, I know housing starts were up 15%. But if you look at average housing starts over the last 30 or 40 years, it's about 1.5 million units.
Right.
It's now averaging about half that. So it can't be good. And you look at construction workers, peak was 8 million, it's now 5 to 6 million. So the real economy is doing it really tough, and that's not fundamentally going to change, which means that when push comes to shove, our elected representatives are going to look very, very carefully at their re-election prospects, which means they will say, which is the lesser of two evils, continuing this, running a massive budget deficit, is probably the lesser of the two evils, knowing full well that it's very easy to finance when you've got the Federal Reserve on the other side. People forget the Federal Reserve has been buying 70 to 80% of all U.S. new government debt, either directly or indirectly by creating reserves so the banks buy them. So the financing is not an issue, and if you look at the interest rates are not an issue because they're very, very low. So I think what they'll do is they'll hatch up some sort of deal where some of these tax cuts are continued in some shape or form. The payroll tax cut, I think, the Democrats want it, the Republicans don't. They'll come to some arrangement on that. And so the fiscal cliff will be put forward, and then we'll have the Barney around March next year about the budget debts and the debt ceiling. But it'll keep getting pushed backwards because the real economy is going to be weak. And there is no political resolve in the United States, or indeed anywhere else in the world, to deal with any of these problems.
What happened?
So we're just going to keep rolling the problem.
What happened to politicians? Did they all? Was there just a nuclear explosion that every politician around the world became? They just forgot what their purpose was.
Well, there was actually a very famous saying by Max Weber, the German sociologist. He said, "There are those people who live for politics, and there are those people who live off politics." We just have a political class now, which is a bunch of professional politicians who live off politics. And they only have really one ideological position, which is, I want to get reelected.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no actual honesty about this process. And, you know, you're not going to get a Winston Churchill speech saying that all I can promise you is, you know, more hardship. You're just not going to get that in this environment.
Right.
So I think this problem is now almost totally insoluble until the system gradually implodes into a prolonged period of Japan-like stagnation. And that's where we're going to get to. And I'm actually now absolutely convinced that essentially the policy weapons that we have are pretty much exhausted. We don't actually even understand some of the relationships.
Right.
The debate that's going on
right.
between the IMF and other people about austerity. And as you know, the IMF at the meeting announced that budget cuts are having a bigger effect in terms of GDP contraction than they anticipated, because this is what we call the multipliers. If you cut government spending by 1%, how much is the effect on the real economy? And
mm-hmm.
people thought it was around half. It's actually turning out to be larger than that. But it's absurd, because if we don't know what the effect of these budget cuts is on the real economy, how the hell can we actually manage anything?
Yeah, no,
it's
I hear
absurd
you.
To actually try to even do this.
Yeah.
And I think what's going to happen is that we'll find policy and political impotence becomes a writhing feature. And I think the other thing which we haven't talked about is the social discontent, not so much in the United States as yet, but you look at the unemployment levels in Europe of 25% and youth unemployment over 50%. I just don't know how long you can hold a society together under those conditions. So I think the political classes are going to essentially find the future extremely challenging.
Mm. Now, when we look at that, we have to obviously talk about some of the effect on markets. That's what we talk about on the show, a bit of investing. And corporate earnings, it's interesting. This quarter was expected to be a little bit of a downstroke from the last quarter, and it's going to be the first down quarter of earnings comparably over quarter over quarter over year. And what we are finding is that many companies are missing estimates, and obviously we know how companies feed information to analysts and analysts craft their estimates and all that, but they're missing their estimates, and at the same time, and probably more importantly, revenue numbers look really paltry compared to what we've seen and what we should expect
to see. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I think this is a discussion that we've had on and off over the last about 18 months, which is that everybody focuses on the earnings. And the first thing we do is focus on expected earnings versus actuals, which is so massage, it's meaningless. Now, I'll give you an example of expected earnings versus the real earnings. You look at banks, and everybody's going, well, the banks beat. You know, J.P. Morgan had a whopper of a quarter. They beat the numbers that everybody expected. I'll give you two ways to think about J.P. Morgan. One is, look at their return on equity. It's awful. You know, it's in high single figures compared to in the mid-20s at the peak, or high teens for some banks. The second thing is, I look at their balance sheet and say it's a $2 trillion balance sheet. Now, they're paying, the average U.S. bank is paying 18 basis points on its deposits. So assume half the balance sheet is deposits, which is roughly right. So that would be $1 trillion on which they can just raise money at 18 basis points by 10-year treasuries at, say, 1.8. So they should be making roughly $16 billion a year, doing nothing with no cost. And you sort of look at that and say, well, hang on, are they doing really well? Or is their real business effectively a actual drag on earnings? So the first thing is expectations versus the reality is meaningless. The second thing is, what I have been looking at for the last 2 or 3 years is revenue numbers only. Because I know the earnings numbers can be massaged, because people have cut costs, people have done lots of funky things. Also, in the end, we all know a company has to grow its revenue line. It has to sell its products. And it's the smoothness of that and the sustainability and the quality of that that counts. And basically, they're not selling things. Because, let's be honest, there is no demand.
Yeah, that's
or demand is much flatter. You look at even the tech sector, which did very well for a while there. It's not terrific. And there's a lot of cannibalization going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, Apple does well, RIM gets obliterated.
Right.
And so you basically see this sort of cannibalization going on within the sector. And unless those revenue numbers come back, effectively, I can't see how you can sustain the actual underlying profitability. You can cut costs only so far. And I think there's two ways this will resolve itself. One is growth comes back. If growth comes back, then the revenue numbers will obviously move up, in which case the actual valuation is justified. If, on the other hand, growth doesn't come back, there is no growth in the revenue line, at some point the valuations have adjusted the reality that these companies' earnings base has shifted down.
Well, one of the things that I've looked at recently, because we're writing our quarterly piece, is there's a variety of things, and one of the subtexts of the discussion is what does it look like moving forward in terms of earnings? So if you look at analyst estimates of the S&P 500, and you start looking at those, you can take a look at two things. You look at the estimates for EPS over the next several quarters, and you look at the estimates for revenue over the next several quarters, okay? Now, what's interesting to note is that you see a kind of a U-shape. You see the last several quarters, you know, the earnings were good. It came down into this quarter. They dipped down below the line, and then they're going to start ramping back up over the next 4 or 5 quarters. And when you look at revenues, though, revenues come down, and they come up a little bit, but not much. And there's the spread between the two is enormous. And the question I have is, how do we have earnings estimates at the, you know, going back to peaks again without revenues ramping up? One of a few things has to happen. You either have to have a realization that this is the case and margins are going to get squeezed, and therefore you're going to have to readjust your pricing on your stocks, or a company's going to have to raise their prices. And then that's another issue, right? That's another strain on consumers. But you can't have both. You can't have a level revenue. Oh, and there's one more thing. The other thing is to cut expenses. And obviously we know how that's done, because the most efficient and cost-effective way and immediate way to cut expenses is to fire people. Human capital is one of the most expensive things in many companies. And that's why technology has done so well for some time, right? So how is this all reconciling out? Is this what you're seeing also?
I agree with you 100%. I don't think this actually makes sense. And this is part of what I call this absolutely, completely dysfunctional market. So you look at the corporate valuations, they don't make any sense. Because revenue's not moving up, profits are moving up because of cost cutting, you're cutting heads, they're not going to consume, you're selling consumption products, who's going to buy them? And to some extent, people have forgotten that the demand from emerging markets, particularly for a GE or a company which makes sophisticated equipment, a Caterpillar, and so forth, emerging markets have been a sort of safe haven for them. And there's two aspects to that. One is the U.S. dollar weakness means they're more competitive relative, particularly to European and Japanese producers. And they've done really, really well. Now, there's two headwinds that they're coming into. The emerging markets are slowing down quite quickly. You know, I know of people in Europe who make heavy equipment and particularly machine tools who are saying they haven't received an order for the last 6 months. And that doesn't actually augur well on the demand side. The second thing in the U.S. is a specific factor. The U.S. dollar is under upward pressure. And if the U.S. dollar starts to show upward pressure, A, you get uncompetitive, besides which the translation on foreign earnings is actually going to be negative for the U.S. earnings seasons going forward. And I think those are the kind of things that come in. But, you know, this dysfunctional nature is actually more widespread. Somebody asked me recently what I thought of buying different asset classes. I said, I don't know, because the correlations between them are one. I'll give you an example. If you think about it,
right.
If all these policy measures are going to restore growth, you should buy equities. Right. It's simple, because right. If you go back, equities should go up in value. Now, the second thing is, if you don't believe in that and you believe all this money printing is going to cause hyperinflation, you should buy commodities like gold and hard assets. Now, the third thing is, if you don't believe in that and you believe in deflation, you should buy bonds. Now, bonds, commodities, and equities are rallying simultaneously or coming off simultaneously, which leads me to believe that nobody has the slightest idea of what the future looks like. Yet we sort of make these prognostications. I just think we live in a world which is completely crazy. We have basically no way of knowing what the true value of anything is. And it's very, very difficult in this environment to make anything other than a very short-run trading decision.
Yeah.
Which is sort of, I always use the analogy that investing today is a bit like the scene from When Harry Met Sally. You remember the scene when Meg Ryan fakes an orgasm in Katz's Deli in New York.
Yep.
And that's not the interesting bit. The interesting bit is an older woman who's sitting there and the waiter is hovering around her and says, remember, what'll you have? And she looks at Meg Ryan and says, I'll have whatever she's having.
Right, exactly.
And every investor seems to be doing the same thing.
You know, it's funny because, you know, we talked about the cycle of the daily movement of things. You know, Japan's market has been up a bit over the last several, I guess, a couple of weeks or whatever. But their numbers are coming out just absolutely atrocious. You know, while their yen is moving higher, so that's, you know, or actually lower for them, the yen's moving lower, it's good for the situation where exporters can make more money. The fact is that their exports recently in their manufacturing has hit lows not seen since the tsunami. And that, I mean, that's some bad numbers. You know, China's numbers, you know, everybody was excited the other day when the flash index came out at 49.1. You know, one of the things that always troubled me is, you know, a 49.1, a 48.5, it's still in contraction mode. It's not in, you know, so you're still negative in that. And everybody got kind of a little excited temporarily that China was actually maybe coming out of their little slump. At the other side of the coin, when you look at it, though, and you have to think about this, then you realize that the knee-jerk reaction to move things higher came down because now there's less of a potential for stimulus, which is really all the markets want. It's this whole stimulus play.
I think you're absolutely, again, right. It's actually quite funny because of this whole process. And Japan's a very good example in point. You know, I wrote some time ago that the only good thing about Japan, that every man-made and natural disaster that could actually happen has already happened to it. So it must be factored in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's basically what people are looking at. It's like the Doors song, you know, I've been down for so long, it feels like up to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's just crazy the way people are actually going about it. But, you know, if the world is mad, you have to be mad with them. And I think the only way you can trade this is basically to trade this volatility, because there's no point in making long-term decisions, because essentially you can't, because there are three or four dynamics here which are really important. One is the markets are purely policy-driven now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as your point about the stimulus and everything else, is what are the governments going to do? What are the central banks going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the first question. And if you know what they're going to do, well, you're a better man than I am, because I don't know what they're going to do, because I don't think they know what they're going to do, because they sort of lurch from one crisis to the other. The second thing is that effectively there are so many unknowns now in terms of how people react, what they do, and almost every principle that you think of, like a normal cause and effect in policy decisions, normal return to growth, which is a business cycle, or even things like global free trade, where how long that's going to continue, is going to be up for grabs. It's very, very difficult to know. And the last thing is, the social and political instability that this is going to breed is almost entirely unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, remember, we talked about, everybody's talking about Greece leaving, which was the famous Grexit phrase. And basically, now I talk about the Greek bear hug, because everybody's realized that the Grexit can't be managed after people spent months telling us, oh, it was all manageable. Now they've decided, oh my God, this can't be managed. Now they don't want to let Greece go. And they're willing to throw another $20 billion at Greece for the next 2 years in the hope that they will get their finances into order. And I said, you can give them 2 years, you can give them 20 years, you can give them 200 years. It's not going to make the slightest difference. They're not going to get their finances into order.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simply beyond them at the moment to do that.
You got to be impressed with Greece, boy. They know how to play a game. I mean, and get some big money extracted. They know that, you know, without them and this whole, a lot of things fall apart. And you know, because of the dysfunction that will occur if they have to leave the EU, obviously, you know, between changing of money and obviously of bonds and of, you know, the total process. So they know that they basically can press on the various powers of Troika and all that as much as they want, because in the end, they're going to have to give in.
You're absolutely right. If you look at, there's a very famous statement by Keynes, which was that if I borrow £100 from a bank, I have a problem. If I borrow £1 million from the bank has a problem.
Right.
And the Greeks have figured this out. And they figured out that actually Germany and France and all these people have far more to lose than they do. And, you know, I many, many years ago, would be at least 25 years ago, or probably not, about 20 years ago, I read Aristotle and Narcissus' biography. And it was actually very funny. There's a line in it which always sticks with me. He gave advice to people of how they should succeed. He said, the first thing is, you should always live in the best street, in the best house, in wherever you're living, even if it means living in the stairwell. The second thing is that you should always be seen at the best restaurants, even if that means, you know, nursing a cheap drink for the entire evening. You should always have a suntan. And the final thing is you should always borrow big from your bank. And the Greeks actually live up to those tenets perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Exactly right. So let's kind of move around to your neck of the woods. There's been some talk about, you know, the budgets are screwed up in Australia due to the fact that commodity pricing has really kind of unraveled and they didn't expect things to be what it is. And you got the pissing match between Japan and China over those little bitty islands in the middle of the China Sea. And that's really backfiring. It's hurting Japan more than it is China, in my opinion. Because the Chinese are saying, hey, screw you, we're not buying Japanese products. And that's really just a big problem, which is probably showing up in their exports and their manufacturing. What's your take on this whole thing? I mean, how's this going to end in terms of commodity pricing, demand in China and Japan?
Well, I think the commodity prices have two different dynamics to it. One is purely the industrial dynamic. The other is what I call the political or resource security dynamic. The real industry dynamic is pretty straightforward. It's purely a function of supply and demand. Demand is weak because the big buyers, and don't forget, China now makes up in many commodities 40 or 50% of the market. And if they're slowing, basically that's going to have some effect. And Europe and North America and even some of the other BRICS like India and Brazil are slowing. So the demand side is a little softer than it used to be. But the most important thing people forget is why this so-called commodity supercycle started. In the 1990s, commodity prices were awful. In real terms, they'd fallen hugely. Nobody invested. So there was this huge shortfall in investment and capacity. But once China and India started to power ahead, what happened is every mining company actually started to invest. Now, I do work with some mining companies, and it's always frightens me. Because basically what they all do is model a mine, and they'll say, does this look all right? And I'm saying, well, you're assuming the price is going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
But I bet you there's 30 other companies around the world which are also investing in capacity at the same time. And all that capacity is going to come on stream at around about the same time. What makes you think that the price will go up? They go, oh, because we are better than everybody else. And I said, really? That's kind of amusing, because I can tell you three other people I speak to who think they're better than you are. So basically, I don't understand this.
Right.
And what's going to happen is that supply, particularly in things like copper, is going to increase sharply, and iron ore is going to increase sharply. And that's going to have a huge impact on the industrial dynamics of these metals. That's the number one thing. The second thing is, I think longer term, I think there's a different dynamic playing out in certain industries. Energy is a good one. Simply because people want resource security, and nobody is more paranoid about resource security than China. And they really want to assure themselves of energy, food, and some other some valuable metals and so forth that they need for their industrial processes. And to some extent, the battle in the Yellow Sea over the Senaku Islands is part of that debate. And to some extent, it's also unresolved issues from the Sino-Japanese history, which, as you know, is not exactly without its blemishes mm-hmm. over long periods mm-hmm. of time. Remember, Japan occupied parts of China and called it Manchukuo in the run-up to the Second World War. And under those circumstances, all of those emotions, plus this desire for resource security, is going to play out. To give you some idea of the ludicrousness of the debate, at one stage, as recently as 6 months ago, the mining industry in Australia was going to drive the economy into perpetual growth today, the headline is BHP Billiton, which is one of the world's largest mining companies, is seeking government assistance because they believe without that the mining industry is threatened.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it was just a couple of years ago, the stories were that miners and people working were making just ungodly amount of money. The jobs were just plentiful, and it was just especially in Australia, it was a paradise for anybody that was working in the mines. I mean, it has shifted around so dramatically of late that it's pretty frightening. But let's kind of move over to the some of the things that are happening with prices of oil. We know about that same kind of situation. There's a lot of oversupply and all. What is your take on the discussions that have been going on with high-frequency trading? You know, it's kind of been brought up again because there's been a few mini crashes, the one in India recently, a few little things here and there. We've seen some kind of bugaboos in the U.S. markets recently that resolved pretty quickly. And, of course, the one that happened with Knight Capital. Is anything going to be done about this? Does anything need to be done about this?
I think you've got to go back to real basics. The first thing is, what is the purpose of these markets? And the purpose of the market is pretty straightforward. It's for companies to raise money for hopefully good investments. And secondly, to enable people to buy and sell stuff in the secondary market for liquidity or investment purposes. That's the real purpose of the markets. To put this into perspective, if you look at today, what the structure of that market is, roughly, and there's disputes about these figures, anywhere between 50 and 70% is what we call high-frequency trading. But the most important aspect of that is not the high-frequency trading. Today, the average holding period of stocks is measured in seconds, mm-hmm. not in months. But even among the institutional investors, what's happened is the holding period of stocks has come down from something like 7 years to like 7 months. Mm. So the fundamental structure of these markets has become more trading-oriented. The second thing is, none of this is new. In the old days, you didn't have computers, but you had specialists on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, or jobbers, as they were known as in London, who basically did the fills. Basically, and on futures markets, you had locals who basically provided the liquidity. All we've now done is using high-frequency trading to fill that gap. However, the high-frequency trading has taken on a life of its own because computers can do things which human beings can't do, and they're faster and so forth. So they've now started to introduce volatility and almost an artificiality to the market. And I think there are two competing issues. One is you can't really get rid of them because you need somebody to provide liquidity. On the other side, you don't want them to destroy the basic function of the market. And the regulators are trying hard to sort of manage this, the economy, in different ways with regulation and so forth. But the problem is, it's not clear to me that they can find the balance. You either go one way or the other. And to be honest, I personally think they should err in favor of preserving the original purpose of markets rather than liquidity. Because liquidity, in my judgment, is a grossly overrated characteristic of most markets. Mm-hmm. Michael Milken famously said once, that liquidity is a commodity you can have as much of when you don't need it, mm-hmm. but you can never find
right.
when you need it.
Right.
So I don't think liquidity is that important. I think if you see what's happening in retail equity land in terms of the desertion of markets because they believe these markets are manipulated, they're fixed, they're too volatile, I think once you lose that, then you lose the fundamental reason you have financial markets at all. And I think that's a very dangerous thing to happen.
Yeah, and one of the things that we have seen is the statistics say that many retail investors have pulled their money out of mutual funds, et cetera. I've always wanted to see where they've actually put their money. Has it gone into ETFs? Has it gone into alternative assets? I mean, because we really don't know what has happened with that. But, you know, ever since, even through the last 2 years, 2.5 years, the money has consistently come out of equity, mutual funds and equity markets from the retail investor. And that's kind of a strange phenomenon. There's a strange situation because, you know, markets are moving and it can't be just, you know, the futures and, well, there's a lot of futures and ETF players, but it can't be just professionals only. You know, the retail has to play a part in this whole thing. It's just a very strange phenomenon right now.
I think that's right. And I think some of that money has obviously gone into bonds and into bank deposits because of the fear of volatility. And I think you're right, the people who've stayed in equities have moved from some of these funds into ETFs. You just have to see the growth of the ETF market overall. So that must be some of it. But I suspect, given the environment, some of it's sitting in mattresses because people are just so petrified about the value of anything.
Yeah, well, let's you and I go do some mattress hunting. It'll take a little quicker. You pick it up, I'll rip it open, and we'll go from there.
Indeed. Do you know what happened in Japan? I remember during the late 1990s, one of the biggest growth industries I accidentally happened to stumble across was home safes, because banks were not paying any interest, in fact, charging to actually keep money. And what we discovered was there weren't that many people who made home safes, just couldn't keep up with demand, because people just had these safes at home, which they would literally draw money out of banks and just basically stick it in the safe. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
So perhaps we should go not looking for mattresses, but investing in safe makers.
Yeah, safe. That's a good point. Listen, Japan has a great idea. Listen, remember how it was always like they had the longest lifespan, and, you know, Dan and yogurt commercials would always have the Japanese because that they ate yogurt and that's why they live so long, and people in Japan live so long. You know, that it turned out that there's a lot of people who actually died, but they didn't tell anybody, because they would continue getting their social payments from the government for decades for the rest
Indeed.
Of the family.
There's a very famous case of some official noticed that there was somebody living in their municipality who was 125 years old, according to the records, and he wanted to basically give him a medal celebrating his longevity. And every time he would turn up at this person's house, he would be out. And he thought it was very strange that a 125-year-old was gallivanting about and never at home. And eventually they found that he had died almost 30 years ago, but his body had been almost mummified, and they just literally filled the bathtub with formaldehyde, and he was there. And the reason was that the relatives needed his pension payments to make ends meet. It's very, very sad. But to also give you some idea of the dynamics of Japan, the actual sale of baby diapers, the number of baby diapers sold in Japan, is less than the number of adult diapers.
Nice.
Which is quite a remarkable statistic when you think about it.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Das, we always appreciate you being on. And, of course, you can find Das all over the web. He has some great books out that you need to to go buy. You have, what's your latest one? You have Extreme Money.
Extreme Money is the latest one. And last.
I know. I wrote two books. I'm done. I prefer writing shorter pieces, don't you? It's a much more...
I prefer not writing at all.
You write a lot. You're a great writer. You are a great writer. I just got your latest piece.
I will keep writing shorter pieces. That's true.
Go check out everything on Amazon. We'll put some links on the website as well. Das, you are a pleasure and a treasure. I thank you for coming on.
It's very nice of you to chat with me, Andrew. All the best.
All right. Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks. Take care now. Good luck.
Always pearls of wisdom. I mean, it's more than pearls. It's like just throwing gold nuggets out there. Everything that seems to come out of Das's mouth. I love having him on because he just does it in such a great, concise, and a non-emotional and very well thought out manner, where he brings us the information that is just so well researched. And I mean, if you haven't read his work, he's just a brilliant writer and uses such not only colorful but descriptive ways of bringing you to the point without too much information that is not usable. So I just really, it's one of the greatest things, having him as a guest. And I know that so many people ask about having him all the time. So there you are. I had him. And I think he's great. We have some other great guests coming up. Still trying to get Doug Cass on here. We'll see if that ever happens. And we have an author coming on next week. That wrote some very compelling work. I haven't finished that, so I'm not going to make a comment yet. We'll see if it actually makes any sense before I ask him any questions. And the only thing I'll also mention to you is that if you haven't already, make sure you bookmark thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We just started wrapping up Stocktoberfest, where we had close to probably 60 stocks analyzed. And on the top of right in the middle of the Disciplined Investor, you can click on Stocktoberfest schedule, then click the link on any of the stocks that we actually covered, and you'll see lots of data on there and exactly the analysis. And remember something, that the information is as of the date that it was published. But you can take a look at that and maybe see how the stock has done since then in our analysis. It's pretty, I think it's very rich and robust in terms of information, and providing not only the information with regard to how we are able to provide the fundamentals, but also the technicals and score together. Good stuff. All right. Well, thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz once again. Go check out The Disciplined Investor. 14 free days of a trial of Trigger Point Research. A great time to do it, because if you want the alerts when there's a time of when there's going to be market volatility, it's now. We just posted, or just about to post, the rundown of our last month or so of trades, and they were pretty significant and substantial. I got to tell you, in a short period of time, we made some real good money. A couple of losers in there, but you know, that's bound to happen in a market condition where it's seeing such great volatility. But thanks for joining me. Don't forget to vote over at podcastawards.com, and I will see you next week. Hopefully you and your family are safe. You have power and you have no interruptions to life. But any of you that are in fact in the zone, you have my best wishes. And, you know, I'm down here in Florida, so we get a lot of these, and, you know, everything will get cleaned up. Everything will pass and everything will get back to normal. So anyway, thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.